Hey kids, this is Mark Arm from Mudhoney, and you're listening to The State of Love and Trust.
Welcome everyone to another episode of The State of Love and Trust. It's a Pearl Jam podcast, and I'm one of your two hosts, Jason Carapesi, and alongside me, as always, is
Paul Guillieri, 2024.
Happy New Year, Paul.
Indeed, Jason. What an exciting year this is going to be. Cannot wait for State of Love and Trust 3.0, as you told me about off air.
Oh, well, you know, the kids say that we've got designs on big changes this year. I should say for the better, because I thought you could change and not be for the better, but these are for the better, these changes, I think.
I think so, too. We are in alignment and agreement, my friend.
We will let you know about the changes when they are ready to be put out into the universe. But for now, again, Happy New Year. Thank you to all of you for joining us. First episode of the new year. If you're a new listener, welcome to the show. If you're an old listener, welcome back. I hope that your holidays were great. How were your holidays, Paul? I didn't talk to you about that.
Mine were festive. And productive.
I would hope so. I would hope they're. I'm popping the mic. I apologize for blowing your ears out, guys. That made me laugh so hard. Of course, what else would they be that's not festive?
Well, I mean, look, you buy a new home, right? And just go straight into work.
Oh, it is your first Christmas at the
exactly.
house.
That's right. First Christmas in the new pad, and so there's just a laundry list of things that never truly got addressed. And so finally I had a little bit of time to focus on that. And so, like I said, it was festive and productive.
I don't know why that made me laugh so hard. Like, of course it's going to be festive, but you're right. It's the first.
Thank you, Captain Obvious.
It tickled me. Anyways, I apologize for blowing your ears out. It's gonna be fun to fix and post. Happy 2024 to all of you. I don't know what you guys did on your New Year's. I had to work for a little bit, and then I was at a party with children and adults till like 10. Isn't that weird?
Playing
Mario Kart.
Okay.
Which is fun, but like, come on. I was tired.
Did it have a Pearl Jam soundtrack at least?
It did not. That would be great addition to Mario Kart. Nintendo, get on that. Speaking of Pearl Jam, this is a show about Pearl Jam, mostly, I think. So hello to all of you again. Patrons, welcome. We love you guys, and we appreciate all that you do for us. If you guys don't know, a little bit of housekeeping out of there before we get into this thing. If you guys didn't know, we've got two brand new beautiful t-shirt designs that you might be interested in. Mm-hmm. Go check our Instagram for that. One is Vitalogy adjacent, and one is very reminiscent of the 2000 bootleg Digipacks, I guess you could call them.
Yeah, those binaural boots with the, you know, the messy cardboard and the kind of sloppy stamping.
If like a kid, like a drunk child, had a stamp and tried to put it on the cardboard, that's what it looked like, right?
I loved it, by the way, and I'm thrilled about these designs.
They're awesome.
I cannot wait to rip these shirts.
Yeah, so those are available to you now. If you'd like to get one, go ahead and slide it in the DMs, and we'll get you sorted. And the Tivoli Snake version is still available
Still a winner, still available.
That's right. So all that is available to you, but we're just happy you're here, and we're happy here in the new year, 2024. We've got a hell of an episode today. It's a little chat that I had with a gentleman who's been in the scene for a long time. Mm-hmm. Paul, are you excited about this?
I'm very excited about it. I feel like playing in the mud, which I'm sure tastes a lot like honey.
Oh my God.
That was terrible.
That was, you're not coming strong out of the gates with the segues.
Segues is like, a little rusty. Gotta shake the holidays off.
Yeah. Well, I do, before we get into that real quick, are we excited about the latest tour date? They're playing Bottle Rock up in your neck of the woods, Paul. May 24th, I want to say, is the date.
May 24th, and they got the festival, you know, with Ed Sheeran happening.
Stevie Nicks, Queens of the Stone Age, The Offspring, My Morning Jacket. A lot of good artists on that festival. So I don't know when you're listening to this, but tickets might be on sale now if you're a 10 Club member or on general on sale. So that's the first U.S. date. I'm sure we're going to get more very, very soon. But until that happens, we got a nice little episode for you. And it's the front man for Mudhoney, as Paul really poorly says. So without further ado, enjoy this chat with Mark Arm. And here he is, frontman, singer, guitarist from Mudhoney, Mark Arm. How's it going, Mark?
Good, Jason. How are you?
I am well, thank you. I like to start out these kinds of things with probably the easiest, dumbest question I could possibly ask you. And so I'm going to start with this. The latest single from your last record, Plastic Eternity, is called Little Dogs. And you sing that they're, quote, easy to distract, just give them a little snack, which is beautifully juxtaposed with the next verse where you sing, if you let them outside, watch out for owls, implying that they, the dog, could become the snack themselves. So I guess my question is, what's your favorite kind of dog?
I don't know if I have a favorite kind of dog. Currently, we have two Pomeranians, but we've had a series of dogs over the years, from like a sort of a Beagle Lab mix to a Shepherd type dog, a couple of Beagle-ish sort of dogs.
So bigger dogs are welcome is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, when the idea first struck me, because I was driving home from work and just kind of imagining my little dog greeting me at the door, and it was just sort of like riffing on, you know, lyrics on my drive home. And initially it was sort of like this kind of comparison between little dogs and big dogs. And I was like, no, you know, that's bullshit. You know, I like big dogs too, but I just, you know, I'm man enough to admit I like a little fluffy dog.
I like that. You gotta be man. It's almost like, what was it, years ago when wearing pink shirts for guys was like kind of taboo. And then some people were like, no, you know what? We're wearing pink.
We're going to own this.
Yeah, we're going to own it. Exactly. So let's talk about Plastic Eternity, which I've learned is not a retrospective on Andy Cohen's Real Housewives series of shows. So let's get that out of the way right now.
Okay.
Now, as most listening to this will know, Guy Madison has been with you guys since 2001, replacing original bassist Matt Lucan. And I didn't realize this until recently, that Guy, who's Australian, moved back to Australia about, you know, 18 months or so ago.
Yeah.
So talk to me about how his move affected the writing and recording of Plastic Eternity.
Well, it was all finished before he moved.
It was?
Yeah. So it wasn't 18 months ago. It was a little over a year ago. Which okay,
I thought it was June.
Time since the pandemic happened, I mean, it was already like loose enough for me where I would think about something that happened in the mid 80s and go like, oh, that was like 3 years ago. And now it's just even worse. He moved back in July of last year. So 2022.
Yeah. So when he, let me back up then. So when he told you guys that he was going to move back, first of all, how did that make you feel initially? Just as like my bandmate, my friend.
There had been similar things in the works. Like at one point, his wife was applying for a job that would make them move to Holland. So
wow.
It wasn't like completely out of the blue that this was like a possibility. And they were actually going to move earlier, but during the pandemic, Australia was pretty much locked down and it was very, very difficult to get in. So they were originally going to move in October of 21. That was their plans, but then it was clear like they wouldn't even be able to get into the country without having to like spend a shit ton of money on quarantine hotel rooms and stuff like that.
Right. So when you first learned about this, did you have any kind of like PTSD of Matt leaving? I mean, like, oh Christ, what the hell are we gonna do? Or did it just kind of feel okay, we can pivot?
I think it was more like we can pivot.
Okay.
You know,
Because he wasn't leaving.
He wasn't leaving the band. He was just moving a great distance away. So like the thing that's going to kind of affect future more than like touring and playing shows, because we can always get together, do a couple practices and then hit the road, right?
Right.
It's more the difficult thing, I think, will be songwriting.
Mm.
And he's been a riff master the last several records. Have been like a lot of the riffs have been his.
Oh, cool.
So he's been very important to the sound of the band.
So
even if he wasn't like coming up with like so much music, you know, just the way he plays.
Sure. So was there like, you know, a lot of bands during COVID, I mean, you know, nothing you can really do but kind of practice and write. Did you guys maximize that time at all? Did you do any kind of Zoom things?
No. I mean, we had Zoom meetings or we would, you know, just, you know, check in on each other and say hi and stuff like that. We write best together as a band, you know, so maybe people were stockpiling riffs and stuff like that.
Okay.
I feel like once we all get in a room together, that's when things start to happen.
So,
and he was a nurse at Harborview, you know, dealing with COVID at the time.
Wow,
we were all kind of nervous about being around him.
Yeah, I can imagine.
As well as him, like not, you know, like going like, I don't want to, you know, he was there in the fucking thick of it.
And in Seattle, you know, the greater Seattle area was kind of one of those ground zero points, right?
It was the very first
the
case.
The very beginning, yeah.
That was known was, yeah.
So, man, okay, so all this is happening. You're kind of stockpiling some riffs. Finally, you get together summer of 21, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So when you finally get into the studio, you guys kind of knock this thing out really quickly, which I think is not totally out of your norm, right? But
we usually record pretty quickly, but we usually go in and well rehearsed,
right?
You know, so the songs are just like nothing much changes. This time we had maybe of the 20 things we ended up recording, we like probably 4 or 5 of them were like kind of complete. Like we knew all the parts to them and the beginnings and the ends and stuff like that. And the rest of it were things that we kind of like either worked out in the studio, like, oh, this needs another part. Let's come up with something. And that was kind of cool to do.
I was going to say, did the pressure of that kind of finite window, especially considering that, you know, Guy has to go back home at some point, did that kind of constrict you? Did that constriction kind of affect the creativity at all to put those other pieces together of the other 15?
It might have amplified the creativity. I don't know. You know, I think we kind of work best when we put ourselves in some sort of deadline.
Mm.
Otherwise, we'll just sit around and not do a record for 5 years.
It's like a dissertation in college, right? I got papers due in 5 weeks. I'm fine. And then the night before, you're like
holy shit. Well, I mean, we're not like, you know, pulling all-nighters right before going to the studio or anything like that.
You mentioned Guy just being a riff master. You've also said before that Dan Peters had a lot to do with this new record.
Yeah, he's kind of like, I think he's been playing the last several years, probably like 15 or so. He's just been kind of, he picked up an acoustic guitar and been just sort of teaching himself how to play. And you know, he knows like chords that I don't.
Oh, like, you know, like those weird, like jazzy chords and stuff.
You know, like I just play pretty much bar chords and.
Yeah. what are you throwing in there? What is that? A seventh? What do you got there?
Yeah. Well, yes. What's that? What's your pinky doing? Why?
You have a pinky? You utilize your pinky? Well, because like most of your records just say written by Mudhoney. So it's kind of hard. I mean, I think most people would assume that you and Steve are kind of the primary songwriters, but like, you're saying Guy's coming up with riffs and then Dan's throwing stuff together. Has it always been like an open forum or
whoever brings something, you know, feels they have something to show, you know, that's
So why then, why do you think that Dan felt more comfortable this time around putting more out there?
He brought a few up the previous record. So mm-hmm. maybe that kind of like
got him comfortable.
Know, I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's a weird fear of rejection or something like that. Mm-hmm. But pretty, you know, open-minded. And
easy. I mean, he's known you guys for 35 years. You would think.
Yeah. But you know, he didn't really like, and one of the things he actually pulled out was a riff that he had recorded at home in like 95, around the time of my brother's
record.
Yeah. The music for Human Stock Capital. He's cool. Been sitting on for that long.
You're holding out on me, Dan. Could use that one. That's amazing. You know, what I really love about your music is there's like this crazy unique cross-section of like silly and fun meets like empathetic spotlighting. And you know, I joked about little dogs earlier, and but you have also have, you know, these songs that are focused on societal issues, like you know, you've got songs like Flush the Fascists, Where's the Future. When you're making a record, do you attempt to balance these approaches at all, or is it kind of just like whatever comes out is coming out?
Usually pretty much whatever comes out. I mean, in the case of Digital Garbage, that was all like just so immersed in what was going on at the time.
Yeah.
Lyrically, and in a way, it was just like, God, I don't really want to do a record like this, but I kind of feel like I have to. You know, I would much rather sing happy things.
I think a lot of people would,
you know, find happiness and be able to sing about it, although that's not really my character either.
That's true. I mean, you alluded to it. I mean, has there ever been something that's just so gut-wrenching or frustrating that you find it hard to like balance it in some way, like having little dogs at the back end of an album? I mean, we talk about that time period with Digital Garbage. That's, you know, Trump gets elected, you know, there's gay rights, abortion rights, whatever you want to think about it. Like, there's a lot of negativity over the last 20, 30 years. You're in the thick of it. Is there anything that's been like, shit, how do I even talk about this? It's so annoying.
Well, maybe in the early days, we largely ignored what was going on around us and just saying about getting fucked up or whatever.
Well, what's important to you at the time is a 25-year-old. Whatever.
I was you know, younger and dumber at that time. And you know, we all cut our teeth in like hardcore,
mm-hmm.
which some of that stuff was hyper political.
Right, which is, yeah, why I kind of...
You know, and
yeah.
My first band was as well. And then with like, you know, Green River kind of like... Just like, I don't want to... What do I know? You know, why would I be singing about like...
That's good self-awareness at a young age.
Yeah.
Most people would be...
No, like, I mean, there was, you know, in Maximum Rock and Roll, there were like all these like bands of 16-year-olds like singing political lyrics about like... Police brutality is like, come on, you're like living in your parents' house.
Yeah, what do you know about that? Exactly. What do you know about real life?
Yeah.
You're not writing Flush the Fascists as a 25-year-old.
No, and Flush the Fascists is, it's more of like I think of that as sort of like a Dada poetry. It's not like a polemic.
Sure. You have said that a key to Mudhoney's success is not giving a shit about your career. And on the surface, I think that's very punk, which I love. But I think it's also kind of wise. And it reminds me of when Neil Young told Eddie Vedder that there's going to be peaks and valleys in your career, but all you got to worry about is being yourself. So regardless of how you view success, because everyone's going to judge success differently, the artists who last the longest often share that approach, in my view. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I suppose like if you just get too caught up in like trying to please the crowd or follow the trends or like, you know, get worried about like losing popularity or gaining popularity, you're like focusing on the wrong thing.
It's like the tail's wagging the dog kind of thing.
Yeah.
Do you think there's too much pressure to do that, or was it easy to ignore that?
for us. We're on such a level that it's pretty easy to ignore.
Sure. But I mean, in general, I mean, as much as you say you don't give a shit about your career, I mean, if it came to the choice of playing music all the time and there's more people who happen to like it, you'd probably choose that, right?
I don't know. I mean, it'd be nice not to have to have a day job, but I don't mind having a day job.
That's fair.
Especially this one, because it's a good place. Working at Sub Pop, it's a good place to work. I have worked very shitty jobs where, you know, you're not really treated with respect. And I think that's kind of like, I mean, work, they pay you to show up someplace because otherwise you wouldn't normally choose to do that.
That's true. That is that's very funny. That's a good way of putting it. Let's go back in time a little bit. I want to touch on some Green River stuff, as you alluded to, and the genesis of Mudhoney. But I find this next thing very fascinating, and it is that in 1985, Seattle passed the teen dance ordinance. Now, I think it's a lot of people who are listening who have no idea what I'm talking about. So can you explain what that was and how it impacted rock shows in Seattle?
There was a sort of a dance club called the Monastery, and it was, you know, like kind of a place where like people could go and get MDA. And it was, you know, sort of a good, I never really went there, but it was like, from my understanding, was like a place that like, that was welcoming to like queer people. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And there were parents of some of the kids who went there who were very upset that their kids were going there. And there was, I'm sure there was, you know, supposedly like this older guy who was like,
because there were shouts of like inappropriate stuff.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So it might have been like, you know, but also that's a place that like they could go.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the people were like, you know, the parents were like pretty well connected and got the city council to like overreact.
Yeah.
And basically shut down any all ages show that you could imagine, except for like a big arena shows. Somehow those were okay.
So you had to find ways to play shows, because I think there's, or maybe you can tell me, is there any fucked up way that maybe it helped bands because it kind of forced you to skirt the law, which is pretty punk after all?
For me, I was already over 21 by the time this happened. So like a lot of like the people who I knew at the Metropolis, which was happening about a year or two previous, they were like kind of like all starting to turn 21. So there were a few bars that we could, you know, have shows at. But, you know, there were also house parties and stuff that we would have, and there was a place called Natasha's in Bremerton, which meant you'd have to get on a ferry and go across the water to play a show, or that was all ages. And I think it probably affected more like the group of kids who are just a little bit younger than us, sort of like the kind of like the Modest Mouse generation, if that makes any sense.
I wasn't sure if maybe your audience was still young enough where that was affecting where you guys could play.
No, I think like a lot of those kids probably thought of us as bar bands because we're playing the Ditto Tavern in the Central and they couldn't get in. So that was like something that was just like, actually just listen to a friend of mine who played in this band, Link, who was associated with that scene, and later on in 764 Hero. And he was talking about his perspective of, you know, they just saw what we were doing as being this irrelevant thing, which is as it should be, you know, even if you're like, there's a 5-year age difference, you know, you make your own thing.
It forced you to be creative, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. But to be succinct, I can't say that word, succinct, close enough. Green River broke up over differences of musical style, not so much ambition. Is that correct?
Well, that makes sense. You know, like...
Like Stone and Jeff wanted to play this type of stuff, and you were like, I want to play this kind of stuff?
Yeah. I mean, okay. I think you could... The easiest things you could point at is like the first Mudhoney singles and then Mother Love. You know, I mean, they're very different sounding things.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, I didn't want to make sure it's oversimplified or anything like that for people who maybe aren't sure of how that happened. To that point, though, you've admitted before that you were and maybe still are idealistic. So I'm going to force you to put on your UW philosophy hat right now.
Okay.
When it comes to both music and life, do you think idealism blunts progress or sharpens it?
I don't know. I don't know if it matters.
Option C.
I mean, that was all so long ago. I mean, there's definitely, you know, people definitely like let the perfect be the enemy of the good enough. Maybe, you know, there's no like,
so I feel like there's a lot of that in politics now. Like a lot of people on either side will be like, we got to have all this to move the things we want to do. And it's like, well, you got to, you know, America's a giant cruise ship. It takes a little bit of time to move things in the direction you want them to move in. So
but
in music, it could be different. I don't know.
It's definitely different than running a country.
Well, sure. I'm not comparing you to the president or anything like that.
You know, you're only dealing with like however many people are in the band as opposed to like, you know, millions and millions of people.
But so far as maybe like writing music, do you think the more idealistic the approach, the more people will or might sign on to it? Or do you think the approach is more like, I mean, well, I guess you said, you know.
I mean, I think the most idealistic band I can think of is Crass, and that they had a very limited appeal.
So you would say that it blunts it a bit?
Maybe. I mean, their music was pretty gnarly, too. So that might have been like, besides the fact that their lyrics were like books.
Oh, man. Yeah. You got to take out your thesaurus to even understand what the hell they're talking about. Sometimes when a band comes together, there's like a lightning bolt in a bottle or a lightning in a bottle kind of moment. And when you and Steve got together with Dan and Matt, did you ever feel that like that unit felt more, you know, quote unquote, right than maybe Green River or Mr. Epp did?
At the time, it just seemed like this was the next thing. Mm. I mean, there was no like, yeah, this is it. We've stumbled onto the thing that's going to last forever.
The formula.
You know, it was just like, oh, this is the next band that like will probably break up within 3 years and move on to the next thing. There was no long range plan, and it's pretty fucking astounding that we're still together.
That's why I'm asking, because I mean, at some point you must have been like, this is really working. Like, when did you feel like you had like a legit footing where you thought that there is a future longer than the 3 years that I thought it might be?
I don't know if there was any time when I kind of thought that. It was just sort of more like looking back, like, oh shit, we've been a band for 5 years now. Oh, weird. Okay. Seven. That's okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You're doing the grind, and all of a sudden you look up and it's been, I feel like it's, you don't have kids, do you?
No.
So I feel like some parents.
But kids are definitely a time marker.
That's what I'm saying. Like you look up and all of a sudden your kid's like 3 years older than you remember them being the last time you like thought about it. And it's like, oh shit, that just happened.
Yeah.
I mean,
a lot of my friends have kids, and it's just like, and some of them, if I haven't seen them for a little bit, like, what, your kid is 22 now?
How did that happen? Yeah. My kid is 4 albums ago. Let me ask about singles. For those who don't know, there's a fictional band in the movie called Citizen Dick who has a song called Touch Me, I'm Dick, and which is, of course, a parody of your song Touch Me, I'm Sick. So I don't think most people know, though, that Mudhoney almost had no actual involvement in that film or its soundtrack. So can you talk to us about how you convinced Cameron Crowe to fix that?
You know, we heard this movie was being made about Seattle music, and it was, you know, Cameron was tight with like obviously Pearl Jam and I think like, you know, Curtis and Susan Silver.
Yeah.
And so like all the focus was, from what our understanding was, like bands in their stable. And so
it's smart from their point of view.
Yeah. And so I remember Bruce Pavitt, who was a co-founder of Sub Pop, mm-hmm. and Steve and I got a meeting with Cameron and was like, hey, there's another stuff too. So like, you know, that's how Tad got in the movie, I right. think, you know, and I had a weird little cameo.
How hard was it to get that meeting in the first place with Cameron?
It seemed pretty easy.
Oh, okay, that's good. That's good.
I mean, I don't remember they're like, oh, we have to break down doors to get here.
Was it, did you try and sell him on including a performance of you guys? Because you know, we saw Soundgarden and Alice in Chains playing in that movie. Were you like, hey, put us over the crocodile?
No, I was trying to get him to do I was really obsessed with Fred McDowell's Shake 'Em On Down at that time. And I'm like, you need to put this song in your movie. Which has nothing to do.
No. That's okay. So then, I guess speaking of Citizen Dick,
I think like he had like a Coltrane poster or something behind him. So I was like, oh, you like Coltrane?
Cameron did?
How about throwing in some blues?
You talking about Cameron?
Yeah. Okay.
I've got to talk about your favorite Yarler, Ed Vedder. I read somewhere that he's your favorite Yarler, so I had to put that word in there because it makes me chuckle, that word.
Yeah, I think as far as I understand, that was coined by Jack and Dino.
Yes, that's true. Well, you saw him arrive in Seattle, and you saw that he joined Stone and Jeff, and 18 months into their thing, they're like this massive, huge band. And I think for those listening who don't know, it was kind of, you know, 94, 95 when Ed had this stalker thing and he was going over to Matt's house to hang out and kind of avoid all that. So can you talk to me about your relationship with Ed and maybe what you learned about maybe the industry, seeing how it affected him?
Well, you know, we kind of had like front row seats to all the weirdness.
Yeah.
And we were never under the microscope, but you know, we saw how things were kind of like affecting friends of ours, and some people handled it much better than other people, obviously. Ed was going through weird shit. Like, there was some stalker that drove her car into his wall.
Yeah.
Just weird, weird shit. Like you couldn't even imagine. I'm just like, hey, at least I was able to go to the store.
Yeah. No, I mean, to see somebody who was kind of just nobody and then all of a sudden somebody and can't deal with that spotlight and seeing him react to the industry kind of taking over his life in a sense through like these, like you said, the stalker, yada, yada. Did it teach you anything about the industry that you didn't already know, or did it change how you were approaching your music? I know you guys weren't obviously in the same level as Ed was in that moment, but certainly could have taught you something about the industry and how to approach fans and yada, yada, yada.
I don't know about the industry. It's more about fame and how you, deal with that.
Okay, fame. There you go.
You know, like some people want that so desperately, and some people just sort of stumble upon it. And there, I mean, there's all kinds of, as you know, like just variations on fame. You know, there's like mm-hmm. people are famous for being good at their craft or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then there's other people who are famous just because they get their fucking faces out there on, and they don't care. You know, it's more important to like be on Real Housewives or something like that.
See, it's all come back full circle.
Yeah. and embarrass yourself.
Yeah, they want to be famous just to be famous.
It's just for the sake of being famous and not even, and then people buy into that. Like, oh, I saw that person on TV or on social media. And it's like, so? But there's a weird thing about fame or like recognizing people.
Like, how does it make you feel when somebody notices you?
One time I was walking down the concourse at SeaTac, and I see this guy kind of coming at me. And I'm like, oh, man, who is that person? That person's really famous. I'm trying to remember or think about who that person is. And he gets closer and closer. And I'm like, oh, fuck, it's Robert Goulet. And I
Robert Goulet.
And I had this weird impulse to, like, run up to Robert Goulet. And, you know, I didn't. But, like, where did that impulse come from? And what was I even going to say to him? Like, I'm a fan of your music. I have no idea what Robert Goulet really does except for, like, the shit I saw on variety shows as a kid.
Jabba doo beep bop doo. Like that.
Why would I, for a moment, think like I really need to run up to that guy? And
fame,
like,
is a weird thing, Mark.
It's totally weird.
I mean, maybe it was, did you feel like, oh shit, this is a blessing that I don't give a shit about being famous when I see what can happen to some people? Even because Ed didn't want to be that big, but he still had somebody crashing through his friggin' wall.
Were you
kind of like, thank God?
Yeah.
How would you handle that, by the way, if somebody was so obsessed that they were like, let's just drive into Mark's house?
Move to the Solomon Islands.
Good answer. So back to the early 90s. You signed with a major label, Reprise, in 92. You released 3 albums with those guys. And from the outside, it seemed sort of a topsy-turvy, turbulent time, especially after Kurt Cobain's death. Can you give me one positive thing and one negative takeaway from that time, just to kind of condense it?
I mean, one positive thing for Mudhoney was financially. That was like the, you know, we didn't go for a bidding war kind of situation. You know, we didn't go for like as much money as we could get. We went for like kind of a more artist-friendly recording contract. And they let us record how we wanted to. So that was, and obviously the terrible thing was just like watching your friends get fucked up and pass away.
I mean, you could see the writing on the wall for a lot of those guys. And it's, did you see when, you know, after Kurt, could you kind of have like premonitions of Lane and those kinds of other guys who just couldn't.
I don't know if I had a premonition, but like, you know.
You weren't surprised.
But yeah, well, no, because he'd never pulled out of the hole that he was, dug himself in.
Literally a song he wrote.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed like he was aiming for it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about happier times then. I've got to ask about this, even though it's a completely stupid question, but it's silly and I enjoy it. And it's the movie Black Sheep.
Okay.
Talk to me. How did you get involved in that movie? And what was your experience like?
The experience was great. I'm not sure exactly how we got involved.
Was a Reprise like, hey, these guys should play in your movie?
I don't know who. I mean, I think, you know, the movie was being made and they needed a band. And our understanding was that they asked Bad Religion and they couldn't do it for whatever reason. So we were next on the list.
Greg was like, nah, not for us.
Well, I mean, I think they might've been on tour. You know, they were like at that point, like they were huge in Europe at that point. Mm.
Did that make up for not being in singles?
I don't know if it made up. It's different.
No, I know. I'm saying playing like as the band playing in the movie. Did that make up for not?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we didn't actually play. We just mimed to a song.
And you know what I mean. Don't get hung up on semantics, Mark.
That was a really funny experience because, like, you know, whenever we've done like videos where we are playing instruments and stuff, it's always really awkward, you know.
Mm.
Especially if there's like any kind of a camera crew there, because you have all the lighting people and the gaffers and all the, they're just like, you know, looking away because they don't want to like, you know, make eye contact or like throw you off your game while you're like trying to.
But you're like, I'm used to that. I play rock shows. People look at me all the time.
Well no, it's just, I think the thing is they're just trying to like not react.
Right.
You know? So it's a really dry, cold experience.
Would you have preferred if they reacted?
Well, let me continue on here with that. Okay. So we did the live thing for Black Sheep. We were kind of like going like, oh man, how are we going to do this? And there's going to be all these people, you know? And we didn't realize before doing it that like, oh no, these are like extras and they're paid to act like they like you. So like the minute we got up there, they're like hopping around. It's like, oh, this is almost like a show.
That is.
The funny thing was like that they had like stunt people practice stage diving.
What an awkward thing to see.
Yeah, they were like rehearsing the stage dive before the shoot. It was really funny. But I mean, that's, you know, like that's OSHA. That's safety.
Oh, of course. You got to get certified for that bad boy.
You can't have like someone break their neck.
Do you remember, I don't know if you watched the Grammys ever. I rarely do, but a few years back.
The Grammys?
Yeah.
I've never seen the Grammys.
Yeah. It's probably not worth watching, but I do. I like Metallica a lot, and they performed randomly. So I was like, oh, I'll check this out. And they performed probably like 5 years ago. And as the Grammys do, they just jam people together that shouldn't belong together. So they had Lady Gaga perform a Metallica song with them. And they had this, you know, little pit of like, you know, basically OSHA certified fans going crazy. And at some point she stage dives into this pit of people. I'm like, this is the most contrived garbage I've ever seen. So it reminds me of that.
Right. Yeah. That was probably very planned out.
Yes. So I mentioned earlier, Matt Lukin leaving around 99, 2000. And, at that point, did you think that Mudhoney was done?
Possibly. Yeah. We weren't sure.
How long before did you think, okay, no, fuck that. We're going to keep on going. And you found Guy.
Well, initially, like Dan's reaction was like, I don't want to do this without Matt. Mm. And Steve and I had like Monkey Wrench kind of reared its head again. So we just sort of spent a year doing that, like playing shows and recording. And after a while, we all got together and Dan was like, I would like to keep going. And I'd been playing in a band called Blood Loss with Guy. Was like, I know who I would like to play with. There were two things that happened. We got contacted by Wayne Kramer, who is producing a compilation record called Beyond Cyberpunk, and asked us for a song for like 10 grand. And we're like, you know, we don't have any money coming in at all. We got an offer to go down to Brazil.
Oh, cool. Was it your first time?
It wasn't the first time we got an offer, but it was the first time we were like, yeah, maybe we can do this. And Guy had just started nursing school, so he wasn't able to do it. And we got our friend Steve Dukic, who'd been the bass player, singer in Steel Wool. And he was like, I'd love to go to Brazil. I don't want to join your band, but I'll do this trip.
I will learn these 25 songs.
Yeah. He was like, you know, a real good friend of Matt's. And he was like, I don't feel like I'm the person to take his place. Mm. And Steve and his wife ended up moving to like Hawaii shortly thereafter. And they've been there ever since. So.
Okay. Funnily enough, my favorite album, at least as of right now, is the first one with Guy since we've become Translucent.
Oh, right.
And one of my favorite sets of lyrics across the entire catalog of yours are these. Been rung through the ringer and spit out a winner. Yeah, I'm a winner because I've got nothing left to lose. One reason why I love Pearl Jam and Eddie Vedder and his lyrics is because I feel like he's really great at articulating kind of what's at the core of somebody. Like he kind of sees them without even knowing them. And I kind of feel like these lyrics are like that. Do you find them to be as profound?
No.
I was kind of hoping you'd say no. you stumbled upon magic.
Just sort of a character study. I don't know.
Is that your UW philosophy coming back out?
Or my...
literature background?
Yeah. My English degree.
I just love that. I think it's so spot on in a lot of ways. And obviously people listen to music and read these lyrics and they always interpret things a little bit differently. Have you ever had any kind of interpretation kind of thrown back at you about one of your songs? You're like, what the hell? I did not think that.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember any specific instance, but I have. Oh, there was a weird. There was a Pitchfork review for Chardonnay where they interpreted that song as us being cranky about young bands. But we didn't, you know, it's like, but no, it's fucking about wine. It was a song like to get Chardonnay off the writer.
Yeah.
That's all it was. And they just like, they read so much into it. It's like, I don't, essentially, we're very simple people.
I'm learning these things, Mark. I'm learning these things. You know, you do your research, you listen to the music, and you try and get some semblance of what a person is. You go, I wonder if I'm going to be surprised. And then sometimes you're like, no, they are who they say they are. They are who they say they are. I like it though. So you guys played, I love KXP, and I love the live performances that they post on their YouTube channel. And you guys performed on top of the Space Needle some years ago. That's kind of like an iconic Seattle band playing on an iconic Seattle monument. Are there any other combinations that you can think of that would be kind of fun? Maybe like Kiss on top of the Empire State Building kind of thing. Like, well, is there anything that comes to mind?
But I guess the Kiss hologram.
Oh yeah. They have the new digital thing.
Since they're not playing live anymore, they could just do it wherever they want. Right. I don't know.
I don't know. Motley Crue playing on the Griffith Observatory or something like that. I just thought it was a really cool, like weird thing that like, you guys, you playing on top of the Space Needle. Like
it was
like,
a totally weird thing. Yeah.
Was it hard to sing with like the wind whipping at you?
It is windy up there and it doesn't seem like there's that much to keep you in place.
I was scared for you. I'm terrified of heights. So I was like,
I mean, my approach to it was just to be like Mark Lanegan instead of like, you know, normally, you know, like just to make things easy. I didn't play guitar. Like didn't want to have to bring like another,
I noticed that. Yeah.
There, try to fit an amp up there because there was hardly any room for the gear that we brought, you know, like guys brought like a really small bass amp. And so like, usually when I don't have a guitar, when I'm not wearing the guitar, I usually hop around a fair amount. And I'm like, there's no way. Just hold on to that mic stand.
you're not going to pull an Eddie and try and hang over the edge?
No. Like an
absolute psycho?
No.
Yeah. Yeah. That would have been bad.
Yeah.
Emily would have been like, what are you doing? No, thank you. So let me ask you this. You're currently in the warehouse.
I just got vertigo just thinking about that.
Right? Dude. Let's back away from the ledge, head down the elevator shaft. So you've been at Sub Pop now for over 15 years?
Since 2005.
Okay, wow, 18 years. Managing the warehouse there. And I'm hard-pressed to think of a band that's been doing the business for over 30 years like you guys, and yet, like, the principal piece of the puzzle has a day job. You know, you think about, like, massive pop stars, and they sing about, you know, tough times and the daily grind that most of us live. But at a certain point, like that life is way far behind them. Do you think that working at Sub Pop while being in Mudhoney has allowed you to have like a more authentic approach towards songwriting or no?
No.
It's just you are who you are. It doesn't make a difference.
Yeah. I don't think like having a day job makes someone more authentic than not having a day job.
It's not, it doesn't keep you grounded.
That's not the measure of humanity.
Oh no, I don't either. I'm saying it could keep one grounded when they're singing about certain things. Like I think about, like I said, certain rock stars who are singing about these, you know, the daily lives that most of us live. And it's just like, you don't remember what the hell that's like. So it comes up as like, just kind of fake. You don't think it affects your songwriting at all?
I mean, my life affects my songwriting. Sure. That's my part of my perspective, but I don't think it's not a comparison to someone else, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could guess about the last time Bruce Springsteen worked a job.
That's true. That's a great counterpoint.
I mean, maybe he never really did, you know, just played in bands out of high school. And like, they're successful enough to like, you know, live in some group house with members of the band when things were cheap somewhere in Jersey.
Yeah.
You know,
I guess that maybe there's a certain,
but I mean, that doesn't make, I mean, you can't like observe what's going on around you or like know people who are like face to face with the daily grind, you know, and channel that.
Okay. You guys, are very good at writing caustic, socially conscious songs, as I mentioned before. Why not write a song about Florida and how much you hate it and just tear it to pieces? You can call it Florida Man.
I think we did.
Did you?
There's a song called Orange Ball Peen Hammer on My Brother the Cow that's actually about an incident in Florida that where I almost got killed.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Can you tell us me that story?
Yeah. We were on tour with the Fluid, staying at like a Motel 6. And we all got together and were like, let's go get some food. And we all pile into a van, like both bands piled into one van to go looking for food. And we were like, just kind of like almost right across the street, like halfway down the block and across the street, there was a barbecue joint. So we just all pulled into there and ate there. And on the way back, Bob Whitaker, who was our manager at the time, and myself, we just started like, it's just right over there. We'll walk back. Don't need to pile into the van. And in that short walk, we're walking. There's a couple guys down the way a little bit. And we're walking and you can kind of hear them. There's one of the guys was like, seemed like very agitated. Mm. And, but I was just like, ignore, you know, don't look back at him. And Bob looked back and he just yelled, run. And I looked back over my shoulder and to see this guy coming at us with a ball peen hammer.
Oh my God.
Which is, and the other two guys were trying to like hold him back, you know, like.
Just randomly decides I'm going to attack these guys.
Yeah.
That seems fun.
I mean, shit like that seems to be happening now too, where like someone just fucking randomly.
I mean, that's happening here in Los Angeles.
It happens, you know, it's been fucking fucked up dipshits throughout history.
Succinctly put.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was reading how you had some troubles in Florida. I didn't realize that was, I mean, I guess it makes sense now. Oh my God. Yeah. Florida's weird.
Like, I mean, generally it was just like, Florida,
I went to college in Miami, so I know what you're talking about.
We only played Miami once, and that was kind of recently, somewhere in the 2000s. Because we, like, in after our, I think, 93 or whatever, we're like, Florida's off the map. We don't need to go there anymore. And then we got, like, this offer to, on a U.S. tour, to, like, play, like, four shows in Florida. And one of them was Miami, which we'd never been to before. And that was actually, like, the probably the wildest and most fun show of the Florida shows.
Not so much the others, though.
Pensacola, weird. I mean, Florida's such a huge state. I guess it's kind of unfair to write off the whole thing, or is it?
Some people have, yeah. And continue to do so. It's an interesting state. In the 4 years that I lived there, it's an interesting state for sure. You guys just wrapped up your American tour with Hoover 3, and I mentioned before we started recording that they kicked ass.
They were great,
fantastic. I was blown away at the Terragram Ballroom here in Los Angeles. So now you're home. You're working back at Sub Pop and Guy's back in Australia. What you mentioned earlier that now that Guy has moved and you're past Plastic Eternity, what is next? Like, how are you going to approach the next thing? Is it just kind of like, I'm going to work until I get the urge to write, and then we'll just kind of figure out how to get Guy over here, or what's the story?
So that kind of remains to be seen. I think at this point, like, we're probably going to try to figure out when would be a good time to do a European tour.
Mm.
Haven't done that for this record yet. We went to Australia earlier this year. And I guess kind of go from there.
Just play it by ear kind of thing?
Yeah.
Does it make you How does that make you feel that everything's kind of not up in the air per se, but you can't do exactly what you want to do when you want to do it? Does it bother you at all?
I don't know if I've ever been able to do exactly what I want to do whenever I wanted to do it.
Okay.
Life has its limitations.
That is true. Is there a specific moment that comes to mind that makes you feel that way?
I would ideally like to get up every morning and go surfing before work, but I don't live anywhere near in a place where I could do that.
How long did you live down here in Southern California? Because I know you were born around here, right?
I was born in Vandenberg Air Force Base, and that was very brief. I think my first 4 years were mostly in Germany. I think I was just kind of there for a couple months.
Yeah. I was going to say, you could always just come down here. Have you ever gone to the Kelly Slater's place outside of Fresno?
Yes.
Is that fun?
That was very fun. And that was Ed brought Jeff and I on.
Oh, no kidding.
As a birthday gift, because I'm born in February and Jeff's born in March. So kind of in the middle of that, he took us down there in 2021, just kind of as the vaccines were starting to become available.
Right. Yes. You mentioned those guys. And before we go, I just want to get, people are going to ask me why I didn't ask you more about Pearl Jam, because that's what, we got focus on here on the show. Do you have any other stories at the top of your head of any of those guys that maybe people haven't heard before?
I don't know what people have heard.
Well, give me a couple of stories or a story that comes to mind that really, really sticks in your brain.
I don't know if I have any stories about a thing. I just have fondness for these people that I've known for a very long time.
Would you say they're the same people as they were 35 years ago? 33 years ago?
No one is. No one's the same person as they were 35 years ago.
You're not?
Fuck, I hope not. Idiot 35 years ago.
That was a trick question.
No, I was fucked up and stupid.
From the first time you met those guys and saw them out there and hung out with them for the first time, let's say, to, I saw you and Steve come out at T-Mobile Park in 2018 and play to 45,000 people. Like, between those two moments, who was Ed then versus now, and who was Jeff then versus now,
Well, Stone was a smart alecky kid in high school that went to high school with Steve. Mm-hmm. Jeff was this earnest guy who played in a punk rock band that just moved out from Montana,
right?
Who did a cool fanzine, who let me sleep on his floor when I was between, places to stay on an air mattress.
He's very hospitable.
In his tiny, one bedroom apartment, which he shared with someone else.
did the other person know that you were coming over?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay, they were cool with it. Good.
Yeah. His roommate at the time was really into No Album.
Mm.
So he was buying all the import metal shit. So that was kind of
Thin Lizzy and Maiden and all that stuff.
Witchfinder General.
I don't know that one.
yeah, Raven,
Oh, yeah.
Hellhammer.
Yeah. What was that one band that had that comeback a few years ago? Anvil? Was that one of them?
Yeah.
Yeah, that documentary or something. Dude, well, I appreciate you spending your lunch hour. I hope it's not your lunch hour, actually, with me and talking about Mudhoney. And I hope that you guys get out there. By the way, have you guys not played a certain area that you'd love to play? Have you been to Japan or do you want to play a certain place you haven't played before?
Well, the only continent we haven't hit is Africa, and I'm not sure how popular the thing we do would be.
We love you in Cairo.
I don't know. We played Moscow once. That's not going to happen again. Not as long as they kidnap Americans. And
I worked there for about a month in 2018. It was interesting.
Yeah.
The people were lovely, but it was interesting.
The people are generally lovely, but yeah. I mean, you know, I had the worst meal of my life there.
I'm sorry. Did you get food poisoning?
No. We got taken to this restaurant, and you know, kind of like weird shit was on the menu, and I was like, you know, maybe the safest thing, this was my mistake, was like ordering the sausage, because I was thinking like Polish sausage.
What was it made of?
Well, I was thinking like, you know, it'd be like a Polish sausage or something like that, where you know it's like fucking assholes and snouts, but it's just spiced and ground up, and this was like weird gray chunks and casing. I forced down 3 bites because I was so fucking hungry, but it was gnarly.
I can't imagine what it was like, what the meat was. Oh god. So not Moscow, but have you been to like Scandinavia?
Oh yeah.
Okay. So really, you've played pretty much everywhere that you would want to play.
I think so.
Okay.
Played Ohana Fest twice. That was sweet.
Yep. So you guys, you're going to try and do Europe in 2024, and then kind of who knows?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Okay. All right. Well, again, I appreciate you taking all this time out of the middle of your Wednesday to do this. And I just want to say thank you for all the years of music, and hopefully there's more to come. I mean, I'm sure there's more to come. Why wouldn't you keep rocking out, right?
I don't really know much else.
There you go. So, Mark Arm from Mudhoney, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you once again to Mark for joining me just a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And it looks like, you know, I know that Guy Madison is no longer in this hemisphere, neither Australia. Northern or Western. I think the guys will probably be in Europe at some point this spring. And hopefully all of you out there can enjoy the new record and all the other songs in the live context, because it was a blast when I saw him, Paul.
You know, I got to be honest with you. And I blame myself for this, because those of you listening probably noticed that my voice never came back again once that interview started. It's because I wasn't there for that one, unfortunately. When Mark was available, I was not, sadly. So Jason carried the torch, as he is apt and well suited to do. That said, though, Jason, I blame myself, because there's a follow-up question that I wanted to jump through.
Oh no!
What did I fail to ask him? The birthday party, the birthday gift, Eddie at Slater's place with Jeff.
Oh, this, the, like, the, what, the
that's surfing? The story I wanted to hear. Like, what did they do? Did they go like fishing? Like,
no, they went surfing. What? They went surfing.
What else did they do? Like, tell me more about that. Like, did they like drink? Sit around and have some wine and come up with some compositions that we'll never hear but can dream about and wax poetically?
Here's what I'm going to guess. Kelly Slater's surf, I don't know what do you even call it? It's like a little surf oasis, man-made surf thing that the guys do. It's in the middle of California. It's like an hour from Fresno. I don't know what you would do. I don't know what you would do to hang out and have fun outside of surf at Kelly's thing. Surf farm. Is it a farm? I don't know. Do they harvest waves there? I don't know.
Better that than salmon with color added.
Yeah. Why would you put that in my brain?
I don't know.
Farmed salmon. Yeah, not the best, but you know what? You got to feed 7 billion people somehow. Anyways, wow. What a segue. Well, next time I talk to Mark, you know what? I'll just say, hey, Mark, I'm not going to talk to you this time. Paul has several questions in regards to our chat from months ago, and that'll be great.
Exactly. Part due. Making up for the hack job. No, honestly, it was a great interview. I learned so much about his perspective on things, everything from dealing with fame in that era, to, you know, stories about being chased by maniacs with hammers in Florida. I mean,
Florida is something else. I mean, I lived there for 4 years, but I never saw anything like that.
No, no, I can't even imagine. I have to say, it's his commitment to just making music is a beautiful thing to see. You see a lot of folks that, and we talked to Kevin Martin about this, you know, where it was like, it became time that, you know, it was time to pivot and refocus his energy elsewhere. And it's interesting to get another angle, you know, another perspective on that spectrum where Mark is seemingly kind of, granted, I mean, Mark doesn't have kids, right? So, I mean,
he's got Pomeranians, Paul.
Yeah. Well, it changes the calculus for sure. But nonetheless, very grateful that we continue to get music from Mudhoney.
100%, 100%. Can't disagree. So, again, thank you to Mark Arm, the warehouse manager of Sub Pop Records, and sometimes the lead singer and frontman and guitarist of Mudhoney. If you guys liked that episode, great. I appreciate that. And we're going to have more fun episodes like that throughout this year. There's already things happening. I'm Mr. Burns in my fingers right now. You guys can't even see it, but maybe you will at some point. Hint? I don't know. Well, that's all for this week. And again, if you would like a free copy of Gigaton on vinyl, there is still a little bit of time to get your reviews in.
A review, subscribe, feed that algorithm for a chance at delicious vinyl.
I mean, don't eat the vinyl, but it is delicious.
For the ears. Better you feed the algorithm before it eats us, Jason.
That's 100%. The ears only just started, and it's still... It's insatiable, is what we're trying to say.
Insatiable.
Is it insatiable, right?
Insatiable.
My English is...
I butchered the segues, but I got my prefixes.
Well, there you go. Go on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever and send us a review. And if we like yours, we're going to choose it and we'll give you a free copy of Gigaton on Vinyl. And there are two winners this time around, so get in there, gang. All right, that's it. We will see you next week with another brand new episode. And until we do, you've been listening to
The State of Love and Trust.